Hi, I'm Dan Barber from Blue Hill and Blue Hill at Stone Barns. You are listening to Food Fridays on the Leonard Lopate Show.
For over 60 years, if you wanted to learn the skills necessary to cook in a top American restaurant, you probably would have chosen to train at the Culinary Institute of America. And now, if you want to learn the skills to make a tasty dinner for your family, you can turn to Cooking at Home with the Culinary Institute of America. Essential techniques and recipes for creating great food is now available in a revised edition from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And joining me now is Chef Cynthia Keller, Associate Dean of Culinary Fundamentals at the Culinary Institute of America. And I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show today, our Food Fridays show.
Greetings, Leonard. Thank you.
Now, I guess we're going to call it the CIA from now on. No jokes. CIA is one of the country's top cooking schools. What skills do you teach your students first?
We teach in our freshman class, it's culinary fundamentals, where they learn all of the basic cookery techniques, how to make stocks, how to make sauces, how to pan fry, saute, how to braise. They're also learning food safety, how to handle a knife, how to make precision knife cuts. So that's the real introductory, the basics.
And are all those skills in this book as well?
They are indeed. The book is laid out very similar to our fundamentals class, where you're focusing in on the different foundational skills. And we really focus a lot on technique. Technique, once you learn the correct technique for braising, you can switch up the flavor profiles to reflect any international style braise that you like. But it's the technique of slow cooking with moist heat that's really the skill to master.
The book has been completely revised and updated. When was the original version published?
I don't have that exact date off the top of my head, but we really wanted to revise this to bring it up to date and kind of reflect the way people are eating today.
But what led to the first book? Were you expanding your mission from cooking professionals to home cooks?
Well, we have a lot of cooking enthusiast classes, a lot of people that are very interested in learning more about good cookery. I think having all of our students that are out in the industry, people see things, taste things. There's also just this huge interest right now in food, return to farm to table. So people want to know what to do with those wonderful things that they buy at the farmer's market and how to prepare them at home.
Well, your school is upstate, so you're a lot closer to the farms.
We
farm
are.
Farm to table can mean a couple of miles in your case.
We're lucky. We're blessed. We're right in the heart of the Hudson River Valley.
Where did the recipes in the book come from? Are they based on what students at the CIA cook, or was the idea to give home cooks a different kind of basic fundamentals?
The recipes in the book were drawn from the recipes that were created by our faculty for our students. The difference between this book and the Professional Chef, which is our student textbook, is that these recipes have been scaled down so that they're making correct portion sizes for folks at home. We make sure that we have a focus that all of the ingredients and equipment are easily available to the home cook as well.
And some of the recipes are quite basic, but others are more complex. Is that so home cooks of different levels can find something that will interest them?
Absolutely. We wanted it to be a basic introductory level course, but we also wanted it to be interesting, and as skills build, the challenge can build.
It's been my experience, unfortunately, that sometimes home cooks will try to make dishes that are too complicated for their skill level.
Often that happens, and I think it's sort of important. That's why we really have things that are technique-driven to sort of start mastering basic techniques, to be able to select a few dishes, learn to prepare them really well, maybe learn to switch up the seasoning, the flavor profiles a bit, and then kind of branch out step by step. The other thing I found when I entertain at home, even though I'm a chef, I really want to spend time with my guests. I don't want to be trying to recreate a five-course restaurant meal where I'm a slave to the kitchen and need a sous chef and a prep cook.
So you make things that either are cooking by themselves while you're talking, or things that are already done by the time the guests arrive?
Well, I do a little bit of both. I love to have things that are slow cooking, things like braises or stews that are, you know, they're sort of ready when I get, my guests arrive and when we're finally ready to move to the table and sit down and have a meal. I also work very much by doing something that we use the French term mise en place, to put everything in its place. So if I do want to do something that's a little bit more cooked to order, like a sauteed dish, I'm going to go into the kitchen earlier in the day. I'm going to slice things up, dice things up, maybe blanch some things, prepare all my ingredients, put them in small dishes, pop them back in the fridge so I can cook very quickly once the actual time to finish the dish comes.
And that is one of the things you stress here, that preparation is key to cooking success. You actually advise people to prep first and cook second. And to think of it as two separate processes?
Well, I do. I like to think of it as sort of that prep first, you know, clean the onions, peel it, remove the skin, get rid of the, you know, peel your potatoes, hold them in cold water. Be able to go through some of the preliminary steps in cooking and then sort of stop and regroup, maybe wash that set of dishes, clean up the kitchen, put things back together. And then that can be done earlier in the day or it can be done before. And then kind of have that transition to service time so that you're not completely overwhelmed by all of this stuff that's kind of crowding up the kitchen.
Well, when you watch the cooking schools, they people often have stuff in all these little dishes, but that would mean that I'd have to have a bunch of little dishes so I can have the chopped onions in one dish and then the garlic in another dish.
Well, you know, you may have little dishes or little bowls. They don't necessarily have to be as pretty or matchy-matchy as they are on TV. You know, I find that, you know, a coffee mug or whatever is kind of kicking around will work at home. But it really does help. So, yeah, you know, plastic takeout containers work great.
There are a lot of staples of ethnic food throughout this book. Pad Thai, polenta, paella, things like that. So you don't want to just do the standard American recipes.
Well, I think we've become such a global community, and we've all learned to enjoy and celebrate so many different flavor profiles. And I think by including the ethnic flavors, it really helps kind of step up your game, keeps the work week interesting perhaps, or makes the weekend a celebration, like, hey, we're going to have Mexican food that we're going to make at home on Saturday night. I think the other thing is when we cook at home, we have a lot more control over what the ingredients are in our food. We can manage the budget better. We can manage our family's health a lot better. So I think there's some real advantages to being able to prepare our own food at home.
One of the things that seems to separate the professionals from the rest of us is knife skills. When I watch a food professional chop up an onion or a mushroom, very quickly and perfectly.
Well,
I think I'll never be able to do that.
Knife skills
or
are...
I'll cut my finger in the process.
Knife skills really are something that takes some mastery. It's something that we really start training our students for very on in culinary fundamentals. You know, one of the key things is proper technique, curling your hand and making sure the fingers on your non-dominant hand that are holding the vegetable or fruit or that you're cutting are kind of pointing straight down at the cutting board rather than sticking out and getting in the way of the knife.
And then it's the angle of the knife as well.
And then the angle of the knife and holding the knife correctly. A lot of people like to put their pointer finger sort of along the spine of the knife, and really it should be curled around on the side, and you should be gently gripping the blade of the knife between your thumb and your first finger and holding the handle with your back three fingers, so it gives you much more strength.
Are certain cuts like a dice or a mince harder to achieve than others?
Well, I think, dicing is a little bit more difficult to achieve because if you really want to have very sharp precision work, they are a little bit more like if you're dicing carrots to be a garnish in a beautiful, vegetable soup. So they do take more time, more practice, maybe a little bit more waste of vegetables trying to get everything square.
And then you have a cut I never heard of, a bâtonnet cut.
A bâtonnet cut, a bâtonnet kind of would translate into a baton or a stick, and it's sort of a longer cut. It's
like a julienne?
It's a fat julienne, a quarter by a quarter by about 2 inches in length. It's a wonderful cut for root vegetables this time of year.
Well, do I have to go out and buy an expensive knife to do this right?
I think that you need to have a good quality knife, and I think you really need to have maybe, you know, if you're going to start out, just one or two knives. We train all of our students with a classic European-style chef knife made out of forged stainless steel. It's important that it has a good handle that fits your hand. And a lot of people get very concerned with the brand names of the knives. But for me, knives are very personal items. And so what fits one, you know, gentleman's hand is going to be very different in a different man's hand or in a lady's hand. So really it's how it fits your hand, because it's a hand tool, and then making sure that the blade is of good quality. There's all kinds of wonderful knife makers out there, and many of those knives are very specific to specific jobs.
I'm talking with the chef Cynthia Keller, Associate Dean of Culinary Fundamentals at the Culinary Institute of America. There's a new book out called Cooking at Home with the Culinary Institute of America, a large format book with lots of pictures and lots of pictures that show us how to do things right. What are some of the other kinds of equipment that we absolutely should have?
Well, I think the home cook, you need to have a good chef's knife. You need to have a good paring knife, a vegetable peeler. Those are kind of all must-haves. I like to have a salad spinner in my kitchen for drying greens, for drying herbs. Great cutting board. Some other things.
Do you like plastic or wood?
I prefer wood personally. There was a big trend for plastics years ago. I think it's kind of come full circle. Plastic you can put in the dishwasher, which is an advantage, but the tannins in the wood are naturally antimicrobial, and it's a little bit softer on your knives. So personally, I like the feel of a wood cutting board.
And do you insist on a blender and a food processor?
I typically have a blender and a food processor in the home. Food processors are really wonderful when you're making different kinds of soups and purees and sauces. So they really have become a big workhorse in the kitchen, especially now with the more high-powered blenders that have come down the pike.
You like Teflon, or do you prefer other kinds of pans and pots?
I like stainless steel pans that are sandwiched with a core of a highly conductive metal like copper. Stainless steel isn't a great conductor, but it's easy to clean, it's easy to maintain, it doesn't rust. Teflon is great for certain jobs like making omelets, egg cookery. I like nonstick type pans also for certain baked goods. They're easy in and out.
Well, I got rid of all the Teflon pans after I read Nora Ephron's recipe, in which she said, preheat the Teflon pan until you see the carcinogenic fumes rise. And I thought, I'm getting ceramics and other things.
Right.
Instead.
We've kind of used the word Teflon, but really they are the new nonstick surfaces that are much safer. But I'm sort of with Nora in that I don't think that that should be the main pan that you're using. Use them for special things only.
When it comes to meat, a lot of cooks struggle with finding that middle ground between undercooked and completely overcooked. Are there rules of thumb for telling when something is done?
Well, if we're talking about red meats and we're talking about roasting a meat, the best thing to do to test for temperature is to have one of these instant read thermometers that you insert into the center of the meat. And then you can go right by temperature. 125 degrees is going to be your internal temperature for taking a roast beef out if you want it to be rare to medium rare doneness. So that's the best way for roast.
Chefs always seem to just know by looking and smelling.
We have a pretty good instinct on smaller items, things that we're grilling, things that we're sautéing. We also sort of use a touch method where we can kind of feel and assess the way the meat is cooked by how much it yields or how firm it is. And as it firms up, that's the moisture kind of leaving the product as you get more more well done and the protein strands kind of tightening up.
And you say that it's important to let meat rest.
It's important to let meat rest. What this does is the cooking process, especially in something large like roasting a roast beef or roasting a turkey, the heat is coming from the outside. The heat's penetrating towards the center. It's heated up the liquid in the meat, the water, and so that's starting to be under pressure. So resting it allows that to relax, allows it to come down in pressure so that when you go to carve, all of the juices are still in the meat.
And mentioning carving, Thanksgiving is a few weeks away. Any tips on carving a turkey?
My tip on carving the turkey is, as nice as it looks in the old paintings, turkey carving is something best done in the kitchen. I like to begin by removing sort of the four quarters of the turkey from the main carcass one at a time. So I'll take off the legs and thighs, sort of take that off as one piece off each side, and then come down and remove the wings, and then remove the main part of the breast. And then the breast can be sliced very nicely, starting from the smallest point, working up towards the thickest part. And then you can really lay it out beautifully on a warm serving platter and have that wonderful carcass for turkey soup the next day.
We haven't talked about vegetables, and we'll take a little break. When we come back, we'll talk a lot about vegetables. Some of our listeners get upset when I only talk about wine. about meat. Some get upset when we talk about wine here.
Okay.
My guest is Chef Cynthia Keller, Associate Dean of Culinary Fundamentals at the Culinary Institute of America. We're talking about her or the Culinary Institute's book called Cooking at Home. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and it's subtitled Essential Techniques and Recipes for Creating Great Food. Stay with us for more. We're back with Chef Cynthia Keller, who's Associate Dean of Culinary Fundamentals at the Culinary Institute of America. And we're talking about a book called Cooking at Home with the Culinary Institute of America, Essential Techniques and Recipes for Creating Great Food, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Did everybody at the CIA contribute to this book?
Many of our faculty members have contributed. I don't know that every single one of them did, but it's quite a broad representation of the faculty.
I mentioned that we posted some of the recipes in the book. We posted a recipe for poached eggs mornay, along with your instructions for poaching an egg. Poaching an egg turns out to be not so easy.
Well, I think it's a little bit daunting at first when you think about that idea of pouring the raw egg, which is essentially a liquid, into another liquid, and how's that all going to work? You know, you kind of look at it. But some of the basic tips: make sure you have the water established at a very gentle simmer. So bring it to a boil, reduce it down to a simmer so it's just moving. A little bit of salt for flavor, and addition of white vinegar into the water. The vinegar helps the egg white coagulate as soon as it hits the water.
So that prevents it from spreading and breaking apart, which is often a problem.
That helps kind of prevent that spreading and thinning. The other thing is to have the freshest eggs possible when you're using a poached egg.
Is this one of those dishes where you need to do all the prep work first because the actual cooking moves so fast?
Well, it's interesting. With poached eggs, there is a technique where you can actually poach the eggs, take them out when they're perfectly cooked, plunge them into a generously sized bowl of ice water. When they're thoroughly cooled, put them on a plate, keep them in the fridge, and then when you're ready to serve, you can then reheat them briefly by dunking them into hot water again and reheating them for about 2 minutes. So if you want to do that wonderful salad with a poached egg on top, but you want to serve it for 8 people, that's the way to go.
But it doesn't overcook it?
No, because it just cooks it, just heats it all the way through to the center again.
We've also posted a recipe for celeriac and tart apple salad. Does any kind of tart apple work for that salad?
Any kind that you prefer. You want to have something that's going to kind of complement the crispness of the celery root. The recipe calls for julienning it and lightly blanching the celeriac or celery root. And then you want to have an apple that's going to kind of have that crunch.
I love celery root, and sometimes I just make mashed potatoes and celery root together. But it doesn't seem to be one of the more popular vegetables. Is it because it's not the most pretty vegetable, do you
well,
think?
Well, I think it's one of those vegetables that's much better known in other parts of the world. It's very, very popular in Europe. Here it's kind of coming into its own. It's seasonal. It's in season right now in the autumn months. And I think a lot of folks kind of don't quite know what to do with it yet.
How do you prevent it from browning once you've cut it?
It oxidizes, so you need to have some type of acid. You can have just a mixture of lemon juice and water, cut it and sort of immerse it into that. A pinch of flour mixed with that water just kind of helps make it stick a little bit better to the vegetable.
You've included chef's lessons throughout the book. Are those more general lessons about how certain kinds of dishes are made rather than a specific one?
Yeah, I think the thing that we really focus on is the technique, the ability to master the technique. And so the chef is going to point out what things need to be in place for doing that technique, roasting dry product, high heat, having, you know, the rack underneath the item to allow the heat to circulate around it. So they kind of hit those key bullet points.
And other kinds of tips is the chef's lesson about hollandaise sauce. Why does the quality of a hollandaise depend so much on the butter that you use?
Well, butter is the main ingredient in the sauce. It's really the main flavoring. So it's very important that you're using a good quality butter because it is the basis of the sauce. The egg yolk itself, though it has flavor, it's really the flavor's being driven by the butter.
So I have to buy an expensive butter to make a good hollandaise?
No, just a good quality butter. Also, the more expensive your butter is, the higher percentage of butter fat, the less amount of milk solids and whey, and really what you're emulsifying, you want the milk, the butter fat is what makes that sauce. That's what's emulsifying.
Another of the chef's lessons is about making a vinaigrette. Why do you suggest adding everything to the vinegar first and then the oil?
Some of the other items, again, vinaigrette is a type of emulsion, so you're mixing two things that don't get along together, the vinegar and the oil. And when you add something like either dry mustard or prepared mustard into that vinegar, what that does is that's an emulsifying agent or a stabilizer, and it's sort of the marriage broker. It kind of gets the two things that don't get along to combine better together. So if you mix that, it kind of coats the vinegar, and then the vinegar more readily mixes into the oil.
You suggest that we make our own stocks? The canned stuff is no good?
Well, I don't say the canned stuff is no good because there's certainly, you know, you have limitations of time. The problem with prepared stocks is that they're very, very high in sodium. So again, that's not an easy way to control the ingredients going into your food.
It's also a good way to take care of all of those things that you cut off of the vegetables when you are when you're preparing a salad, for example, or carrots, all of the leaves, you're often asked, should I take the leaves off? Well, I like them because I put them in a stock.
Yeah, sure. All of the, you know, the tips from your carrots, the, you know, pieces of onion, all those things, you know, you can make a nice vegetable stock with vegetable trimmings. And then those are great to have on hand. You can use them to flavor risottos or to make soups. So having stocks at home is a great thing.
You can also save bones from chicken, from a beef dish, and make different kinds of stocks that way?
Yeah, you can have bones from chicken, just about anything, bones from fish, just gently simmered in water with the addition of aromatic vegetables and some herbs. And the thing is the larger the animal, the longer the cooking time. So fish stock cooks fast. Beef stock needs a long, slow simmer to extract the flavors.
The big problem is storage. You need a pretty big freezer, don't you? Because if you want to put all the stock in one large container, well, then you can't just cut off a piece of it. And if you want to put it in little containers, well, they can add up to a lot of space.
Yeah, little containers can add up to a lot of space. One of the things that we chefs do in our professional kitchens even is to take a stock and then once it's strained, once it's completed, put it back on the heat and allow the water to reduce away from it. And it creates something called gloss, which is a concentrated stock. And that you could freeze in smaller quantities, like in an ice cube tray. We find those very handy for bolstering stews, for flavoring sauces, because it's a lot more intensely flavored than a pure stock because of the reduction.
My guest is Chef Cynthia Keller, Associate Dean of Culinary Fundamentals at the Culinary Institute of America. The book, the most recent book, a revised edition of Cooking at Home with the Culinary Institute of America, Essential Techniques and Recipes for Creating Great Food from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What are some of the things that home cooks should keep in mind when it comes to cooking grains?
Well, grain cookery, every grain is a little bit different. Whole grains are really wonderful, versatile things to have around. I like to kind of cook larger batches of whole grains than I need for the specific meal that I have. So I may cook up some bulgur. I may have it as a hot meal one night and then maybe have it as a salad the following day. Whole grains are great also when we have, especially holidays or we have guests coming to the house, because if there is someone that may not eat the main protein that you've selected, if it's animal protein, you've got a great nutritious complement available.
Some grains have to soak before you cook them. Do you prefer the long soak method or the short soak method?
It depends. Short soak is great when you've kind of got time. You know, you come home, you've decided you want to have this tonight. The long soaking method requires a little bit more advanced thinking. Both work equally well.
And then some using the short soak method call for a simmer. Now, I'm always worried with a simmer because I can get that flame down pretty low, but I don't know, my paranoia, I think it's going to go out.
That can be a risk. So you do, if you are doing slow simmering, you do need to be sort of actively around in the kitchen. If you do have a gas stove, sometimes there's also some diffuser plates that you can put a thicker plate between your actual pan and your flame to just kind of make that heat a little bit more gentle, or even move the pan a little bit off to the edge of the flame so it's not completely on the center.
Can you put one burner on top of another burner?
One burner.
In some cases, when you have individual those things that sit on top of the burner, I'm sorry.
I don't know that I'd be so inclined to do that. I'd be a little bit concerned about the risk, maybe, of the pan being unstable.
About double boilers?
Double boilers also work, but I think to keep a good simmer, as long as you have plenty of water in the pan, you should be able to keep it fairly low.
Is braising for tougher cuts of meat only, or can you braise tender things like fish?
You can braise tender things. You just do it a lot less time. But braising is essentially a slow, moist heat cooking method where you're cooking something in its final sauce, so you get really delicious results.
Now, traditionally, you sear the meat first before you start braising it, but I've been hearing recently that that's not necessarily the best approach.
We still teach searing it in advance. One of the reasons you just sort of start to develop flavor by creating that Maillard reaction on the exterior of the meat. You're developing those layers of flavor, those toasted nuances. It doesn't sear in juices. It doesn't really change the finished product, except it's sort of the beginning of that flavor development process. There's that brown on the bottom of the pan that then becomes incorporated into the sauce.
There are expert tips throughout the book, and one of them is to add a dusting of all-purpose flour when you're sautéing something. How does that make sautéing easier?
It helps with moist items like a skinless chicken breast or fish fillet because the flour is going to absorb the moisture on the exterior of the protein. The proteins in the flour when you go into the sauté pan are also going to brown right along with the protein, so it creates that nice golden brown exterior that we look for in a sautéed item, and at the same time it kind of protects the item from sticking to the bottom of the pan.
Now, you're Associate Dean of Culinary Fundamentals at the CIA. Does that mean that you're working with the newest students?
Absolutely. I welcome the culinary freshman students to the school, and they have their first 15-week semester is in culinary arts.
I would assume that some of them are a lot more skilled even from the start than others.
We have quite a broad variety of skill levels when they arrive at the school. Culinary Fundamentals is an interesting transition for them because some may have lots of skills, but they may not have the best refined habits when they arrive at the school. Some of them have very, very little skill, and so everybody kind of comes to a meeting point by the end of the course.
You say the bad habits. That means they probably worked at a restaurant where they did things in a way that you would probably be a little upset.
Sometimes bad habits might be as simple as just holding their knife in an incorrect way, that they're not getting the most precise knife cuts. It's sort of like if your golf swing is a little bit off and you see a coach and they straighten you out, it's hard if that's always the way that you've golfed.
The food world has changed a lot over the past 10 to 15 years. Has that changed things at the CIA?
I think so. The way I see it is there are more forks in the road for our graduates. I graduated from there quite some years ago, and at that time we all really wanted to be in the kitchen, in restaurants, hotels, etc. Now our students are really much more diverse. They're getting into wines programs. They're looking at various health programs, healthy living, senior communities, college canteens, business canteens. They're doing farm-to-table agricultural studies. They're doing food science, so very, very diverse careers going forward in the food business.
One of the things I've noticed is that in the past, you assumed that an ethnic restaurant had a chef from that area in the kitchen. There was a recent article in the New York Times where the sushi chefs were definitely not Japanese, and we're seeing more and more of that with pretty much every kind of cuisine.
Well, I think it's sort of like studying fine art or literature. The culinary arts are very much the same. So if you really choose an area of discipline that you enjoy and then really choose to make it your focus and an area of mastery, you can become equally expert or if not more expert than someone who may be from that part of the world.
Now, you also have campuses not just in Hyde Park, but newer campuses in California, Texas, Singapore.
Singapore, yes.
Would each school be quite different because of the location?
Each school is unique. The student bodies that they draw are very unique. Our Singapore campus is probably the most unique in its diversity and its location. And, of course, the products that are available, the local flavor profiles that the students are exposed to.
The book that we've been discussing is Cooking at Home with the Culinary Institute of America, Essential Techniques and Recipes for Creating Great Food. We have some of the recipes from the book posted on our website at WMYC.org. And my great thanks to Chef Cynthia Keller, Associate Dean of Culinary Fundamentals at the Culinary Institute of America, for talking with us today.
Thank you, Leonard.